From Cited Media, this is Darts and Letters. I'm Gordon Caddick. Darts and Letters is a podcast about the ideas that drive our world, whether we like it or not. It's also about what's hiding under that trench coat. Canada is a nation of corporate monopolies and oligopolies. This touches basically every sector of our economy. If you want a phone plan or TV or internet, well, in most places, you'll turn to one of three options: Rogers, Bell, or TELUS. These companies account for 91% of the mobile phone market. Plus, they own most of the TV and radio in Canada. If you want to eat, well, billionaire Galen Weston Jr. is here to feed you.
We want to feed our families food that's good for us, food that's grown in our part of the country.
From the low-end no-frills to the higher-end chains like your independent grocer, to Shoppers Drug Mart, and even the Asian-focused TNT. If you see a grocery store or drugstore, it's a good chance that it's Loblaws and Galen Weston.
And that's why you'll find so much amazing Canadian produce in our stores right now.
If you need a bank account, well, six financial institutions have almost 90% of the market share. Or how about an apartment? Well, there's a good chance you're buying something developed by one of those regional oligopolies, like Concord Pacific in Vancouver or Tridal in Toronto. Maybe you want to distract yourself from all of this by just watching the game. Well, unfortunately, a lot of major sports teams in Canada are owned by our telecoms. Then you reach for a drink. It's probably coming from InBev or Molson Coors. These two companies own about half of the beer market in Canada. If this has you all at just a breaking point, if you're actually at the point you might even want to leave the country, even here they've got you. Two airline companies run a duopoly. WestJet and Air Canada have about 81% of the market share. All that stuff, it's really the tip of the iceberg. Those are the consumer-oriented sectors, but there's a lot of others like oil and gas, construction, mining, property development, freight train travel, and other domains. This level of concentration leaves Canadians with this kind of feudal mindset. We follow every little thing our corporate overlords say and do. I guess we kind of have to, because they really do run this country. And right now, there is a high-stake, succession-style family feud over the future of Rogers Communications. That's the telecom giant that owns much of our media, mobile, and internet infrastructures. They also own the Toronto Blue Jays and part of the Toronto Maple Leafs and Raptors. Right now, Rogers is trying to acquire rival Shaw Communications, but there's a slight wrinkle to this plan. The family is feuding. On the one side, you have Ed Rogers, son of Ted, the founder. He tried to oust CEO Joe Natale. He convinced the board that this was a good idea, and they approved it. But then the weekend happened, and they changed their minds, particularly his mother, Loretta, and his sister, Martha and Melinda. They said that they felt misled by Ed, and so they reversed course. Then he retaliated by sacking five members of the board. Because here's where it gets a little technical. Ed Rogers controls the Rogers Family Trust. That trust owns 97.5% of the voting shares of Rogers Communications. So basically what that means is this parallel board of the private family trust has say over the public board of Rogers Communications. So says Ed Rogers, though a judge will decide that soon. Depending on when you're listening, they may or may not have already decided. The dispute is being adjudicated this Friday in BC's Supreme Court. Canadian media has obsessed over this weird public feud, and really myself included. Ed Rogers is being painted as a Trump-loving racist oaf. And it's true, he did visit Mar-a-Lago with his family. Plus, he reportedly tried to sack the Raptors' general manager. Apparently, Ed thinks that GM Masai Ujiri is arrogant, and he was offended when Masai walked into a meeting with bodyguards. That didn't happen. The other side is being led by Martha Rogers, Ed's sister. She's painted herself as this anti-racist girl boss taking on an old boys network. She's been on Twitter throughout this whole feud giving constant clapbacks. When this all started, she tweeted, "I see Ed has appointed himself the chairman. Lol. This should be taken as seriously as if he appointed himself the King of England. Hashtag old guard down." Not going to lie, Martha is pretty funny, but I'm not sure that her hashtag campaign has really caught on. Ladies and gentlemen, these are the people who run Canada. If this was just garden variety boomer cringe, it would be funny, but there's a lot more at stake. This soap opera really does matter, and it leads us to the inevitable conclusion that Canada isn't a real country, it's just masquerading as one. In fact, we're basically three corporations under a trench coat. And on this episode of Darts and Letters, we open up our trench coat and expose ourselves to the world. Later on in the episode, we'll look at the global supply crisis. People can't get their shit. And Matt Stoller tells me monopolies have a lot to do with that. Stoller is an anti-monopoly crusader, a journalist, and author. We'll also talk about Biden's infrastructure and reconciliation bills, and I'll ask Matt to explain how monopolies take root and why intellectuals on both the right and the left are complicit. But first, the succession-style corporate drama at the head of Rogers Communications. Professor Dwayne Wincek is really a thorn in the side of Canadian telecom monopolies. He's a political economist of media, and he runs something called the Canadian Media Concentration Research Project. As you might guess from the name, it tracks our media conglomerates, and it also looks at how corporate concentration affects prices, access, and quality. And of course, just like me, Dwayne is transfixed by this drama in the Rogers family.
I think what we see here with Rogers, and if we look to companies similar to it, like the Shaw Company, like Quebecor, like Cogeco, what we see is a kind of a backwards capitalism. So even by the registers or the lights of modern capitalism or a modern economy, these companies are holdovers from a kind of a prehistoric time before stock markets had basically separated out ownership and control from identifiable families. And you see this, you know, for example, in the United States or Europe, where you can look over the 20th century, you saw the decline of owner-controlled companies, and especially in the kind of since the last quarter of the 20th century, the numbers of owner-controlled communication and media companies just went down. But here in Canada, we have this kind of backwards capitalism where the family oligarchs kind of loom large. And where you get these kind of blowout dramas that, you know, have personalities that kind of give this kind of weird, dramatic oomph to what is often an otherwise kind of boring story that most people don't want to pay attention to.
Somewhat beside the point, but totally the same dynamics. I mean, thinking about kind of like grocery stores, Galen Weston Jr., right? I never thought about it that way that you just described as kind of an old school capitalism, almost like a feudal kind of arrangement. What do you think accounts for that? Why does Canada have more of these kind of family scions that remain?
It's really hard to say. And I think, you know, if we can venture, you know, down a speculative lane here a little bit, I would say that we've had a relatively closed economy working under the shelter of a protective state as part of the nationalist project. And that nationalist project that has protected the captains of industries as the stewards of Canadian sovereignty, if you will. And, you know, I think that has kept the shareholder-controlled company at bay, and it's those elite ties between the captains of industry firmly within identifiable families and the political side there, where we have big name individuals who are running governments and the concentration of power in the PMO, and the revolving door that then exists between Canadian political parties, governments, regulators on the one side and industry on the other side. And I mean, this is crazy in Canada. I mean, Brian Mulroney has a seat on the board of directors at Quebecor. You know, Mila, his darling wife, has a seat on the board of directors at Cogeco. And there's more, right? That's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. The way that the strife here has been portrayed is basically you have on one side Edward Rogers, who is being portrayed as this kind of like Trumpist oaf, kind of racist. He didn't like Masai Ujiri. And then you have his family, Melinda, Martha, and Loretta Rogers, who are fighting, especially Martha. I may have to correct this if I get it wrong, but on her Twitter, she's going on this campaign against kind of the old guard boys network. So I certainly have no dog in this fight, but does it matter which side wins here from the perspective of the average Canadian? Do you have a dog in the race in terms of who ought to win this fight?
I have no dog in the race. You know, if I had to pick, you know, which side of the family I like better, you know, I kind of like Martha, you know, and the matriarch side better. But, you know, this is really beside the point. The idea here is that you have got this crazy, crazy structure of ownership in which a company that controls a minority of the shares exercise control over 97.5% of the voting power in this company. And that also appears to be structured in a way that funnels power right to the top of the Rogers Trust. Right. So this is an autocratic run corporation. And I mean, the Canadian proclivity for dual class ownership has often been remarked upon, even by business school professors, as being way out of line with modern standards of good corporate governance. This is why. Right. And you can't just basically have people, you know, pony up their money and then ask them to kind of roll over and neuter themselves while you take their money and then just tell them to shut up and take your dividends and, you know, F off and then go and make these kinds of decisions that run what are supposed to be publicly controlled companies, shareholder controlled companies. We are so far beyond that. And this is what we get.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the proposed Shaw merger. Where exactly is the status of that? Like, when might that be decided? In what way, if at all, does this drama affect that story?
It's definitely, I think, having an effect insofar that the kind of the capital markets are getting a little bit skittish. I happen to have a couple of clients from institutional investors here who, you know, they feel that they want to pay me lots of money to tell them what I think about the Rogers Shaw transaction. And I'm like, okay, I'll do that. And so they've been calling. Like, they don't call all the time. And like, as soon as this show started to blow up, the calls started coming in. These guys are, and they are guys, they make money whichever way this deal goes, right? Mm-hmm. Up or down. And just the odds are in favor of the deal going through. In fact, the deal is structured in such a peculiar way that Rogers basically has no room to walk away from this deal. All right. If they walk away, they lose their shirt. And this just strikes me as very peculiar. But I think what they're trying to get a sense of is, what are the odds, right? And the sense that I'm getting from them is that the odds are deteriorating, right? The odds have deteriorated twice in the last month for two big reasons. One is that the biggest communications and media conglomerate in this country, Bell Canada, filed a submission with the CRTC for its upcoming public hearing that, you know, basically I could have wrote the damn thing, right? It's like, you know, all over the place in terms of market dominance, concentration, which would be a bad thing for Canadian consumer citizens, for innovation, pricing, and all this kind of thing. And then they go a step further and they say on the monopsony side of things. That is the ability of a combined Rogers Shaw, should the deal go through, to exercise market power over those who provide content to a combined Rogers Shaw. So this isn't just going to screw people on the demand side. According to Bell Canada Enterprises, it's going to screw Canadian culture creators. So basically, you know, and you know this, reading the critical literature, the Marxist literature, like, when is the time ripest for major kind of political breakthroughs or for unexpected things to happen? It's when you have conflict and cleavage amongst the elites, right? And so when Bell dropped its submission to the CRTC a month or so ago, it revealed a major schism in the upper echelons of elite corporate communication capital, right? So that led to kind of a downgrading of the prospects. The second thing is this shit show in the boardroom. I think this is all so amazing, because you know where the prospects for this deal should really lie? If we lived in a real democracy in which politics had power over capital, with cabinet, with the CRTC, and with the Competition Bureau, and these, you know, each of these regulatory agencies having the wherewithal, both the resources, the capacity, and the inclination to actually stand up and say, no, this is bad for Canadians. It's bad for Canadians as citizens, bad for consumers. So the fact that we have to rely on the prospects of this deal rising or falling in degrees upon drama from some backwards, anarchic form of oligarchic capitalism? We're off the frickin' planet. Like, this is just not right.
And you know, it's funny. I was reading in preparation for our talk today, I was reading their submission to the CRTC, or is it the Competition Bureau? I can't remember. I've never read a document quite like this, and I don't know that I had expectations. But the one thing I was expecting it to be very thorough, very well researched, very persuasive, just because of kind of the millions, billions at stake ultimately. And I didn't leave actually reading that. I was like quite unimpressed. You know, they just kind of throw some fig leaves there to how they're going to invest in rural internet and community programming. And then they have these like submissions, mostly from chambers of commerce, that say, oh, we support this merger and it's good for us. It's good for, you know, the film and television industry. And one of the, I have to read this. It was so crazy. I couldn't believe. So they had one submission from David Barnhill, who is an individual who lives in Vancouver, BC. That's all it said. And it says, Rogers did serve the community before, and I look forward to them returning. They are really community-minded, and they do excellent community programming. Rogers is a provider of excellent entertainment over the years and has served the community extremely well through its commitment to arts and to the community. Like, you just said like community nine times in two sentences, and this person has no title. It's like, what is this? Like, right, there's no argument here. So I'm curious about what sort of your take is when you saw that submission.
Well, I mean, these things, they do make you laugh or cry, you know, given what's at stake. And I believe that basically what we're talking about is the communications envelope in which human beings live out part of their lives, right? These are not just like widgets sold on the open market. This is talking about, like I'm saying, creating this communications envelope in which we come to express ourselves at a distance. It's a tragedy. And the kinds of things that you're pointing to there, I think, are common. You know, one, the caliber of Bell's submission itself and the expertise marshaled to build a case against this, and that it was, you know, quite poor. A minute ago, I said I was actually kind of impressed and I could have written it, so I better be careful here on what I say, lest I contradict myself. But, you know, I was saying the general sensibility in bringing up market concentration and monopsony power, you know, I thought that was quite impressive. And I thought that there was some decent analysis. But the thing is, at the end of the day, you're right that these documents are written by people who are paid to write these documents. They have no heart. They have no soul. They don't give a damn one way or another. They're paid to work from 9 to 5 to write down some crap that's going to get sent before the CRTC. And many of the people, not all of the people at CRTC, there are some very good people at the CRTC who I know, who I, you know, have been friends with, or who I've worked with as a professor But for the most part, these are 9-to-5ers and they don't give a damn about parsing the quality of this kind of stuff. They just get this crap in. And so the whole thing kind of floats on this flotsam, make-believe stuff. And so this is kind of the irrationality that is at the very core of one of Canada's biggest markets, which suggests to us, if you're a critical or a radical scholar, that the whole thing is built on a house of cards. And if this is one of the biggest sectors of capitalism, you know, this is, it's like, you know, it's weird, right? And I think we ought to spend a lot more time on understanding, you know, the whole fictional foundations of contemporary capitalism, right? And I think this is really, really its soft underbelly. I'd just say one other point there on those community comments, and I'll give a shout out to one of my PhD students who I work with a lot. He's a PhD candidate now, and he knows this stuff like nobody's business. And that's Ben Klass. He went through the public record and he found, I think, just loosely paraphrasing here, you know, one set of comments submitted by 9 different entities, from individuals to like car dealers across the country, right? It was just like the same bloody letter signed by, you know, maybe the person that you just quoted from wherever in BC, and then a car dealer from Saskatoon, and then somebody else from, you know, St. John. This is theater. It's all theater. This is the 6th largest corporate transaction in Canadian history. And that this stuff is part of the public record is a travesty.
It makes me think of this kind of like Yelp reviews that are all just kind of generated by a content factory. Like the notion that this is how our some of the largest financial questions are being decided by our country in this sort of like kabuki theater or pantomime of something like a democratic process, when clearly it's not. There was a part I'm curious, you and the PhD student you mentioned, you wrote a piece looking at their argument. And one of the things that stood out to me on the question of sort of academia and expertise in this is how Rogers marshaled academic literature in particular. What kind and how they sort of distorted it. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that. What's the role of kind of the scholarly expert in these debates generally?
Yeah, it's huge. It's an integral part of these debates, unfortunately, because these hired guns, they're mercenaries. And I can't underscore this point enough, that these people are hired to make a case and they'll basically sell to the highest bidder. They care not a whit for intellectual integrity. They don't make factual errors. What they do is, you know, they selectively cherry pick facts and assemble them in some kind of contorted way in which the client's interests are supposedly furthered. And because it is kabuki theater and the real decision making is taking place somewhere else offstage, and that's where our institutional investors are working, probably, you know, at a different level than all the stuff that's on the front stage, these hired guns, basically they pollute the pool of public policy knowledge, and they do a real disservice to both policy and to the precepts of democracy. And I'll go even further, because I've been in this game enough now and for long enough, and I'm happy I have been doing this for the last decade, but these guys will actually, they are hired mercenaries and they will do paid hit jobs on critics. I've been the target of that. And I've seen a really good consultancy from Finland who does some great work, one of the only independent consultants that does commercial grade work and sells high priced reports, but without tying itself to particular clients. And basically, TELUS here hired NERA, which is the biggest economic consultancy firm in the US, and whose one of its principals was Trump's telecoms policy advisor, and has also worked for TELUS, Rogers and Bell here in Canada. I'm talking about a guy named Jeff Eisenach. Well, these guys put together a piece with the roster of all the hired guns. It was about 20 names long, where they did a hit job on this Finnish consultancy Rewheel in the context of a pretty big CRTC proceeding that was going to kind of determine in a significant way the structure of our mobile wireless industry, you know, whether they're going to introduce more competition. And these guys just came out and then they wielded this language of, you know, they accused Rewheel of doing a disinformation campaign. these guys are bananas. I mean, they is like so far off the wall. Like, kid you not, I've had phone calls and emails in the middle of the night from these idiots going after me in the most personal ways.
Unbelievable. We'll have to do a whole other episode on the political economy of media research at a certain point. But in the Rogers and Shaw merger, in the Rogers proposal in support of that acquisition, what were the arguments that the scholars were marshaling in favor, and who was making them?
They were making one headline argument here, which is that some people would claim that 4-3 mergers in the mobile wireless industry are bad news. 4-3 meaning, you know, any kind of a merger or ownership transaction that reduces the number of players from 4-3 is bad news for citizen consumers, and bad news in terms of, you know, levels of quality, pricing, the size of your data allowances, and so on. And so they, you know, in this gesture of good faith engagement with rational policy arguments, they say, you know, let's take a look at what the literature and the evidence actually says on this. And so they trot out this one piece as if it's a scholarly piece, and it's from like the Law and Economics Center. And I think that was the name of it. It's basically this big US think tank that has been driving the Chicago school stuff before the Chicago school was recognized as this bastion of free market anti-state individuals that were dedicated to basically destroying the role of public policy in shaping markets. Anyway, so they pulled on one of the latest from the center, and one of its authors, Jeffrey Mann, who is basically the son of one of the forefathers of the intellectual current behind the Chicago school, right? He was the one that set up these judge schools around the states. Anyway, so they wheel in, you know, a study by Jeff Mann and co. from the Law and Economics Center saying, you know, we have some doubts about these 4-3. Yeah, I bet. No doubt they have some doubts, right? I mean, for them, the whole nature of capitalist dynamism and competition is the pursuit of monopoly, right? So anything that gets in the way of the pursuit of monopoly, like a 4-3 rule, a prohibition against 4-3 mergers, or at least a strong penchant against such mergers, of course they're going to see that as wrong. And then you've got another study by Tommaso Valletti, who's a respected economist and academic at Imperial College in the UK, former director of the Competition Bureau within the European Commission, with, you know, 5 or 6 years of experience under his belt, you know, reviewing the evidence and the policy in the EC, in the countries that make up the European Union, as well as in the United States. And they hold these two things up as if they're equivalent. Mm. No, you know, we don't hold up incommensurate things and then, you know, abracadabra, make an ideological piece the equivalent with a scholarly piece by an intellectual that's got, you know, experience in the trenches. That is just wrong.
We did an episode about Koch-funded centers, and there was a law and economics center at George Mason University that I wonder if has some tie-in here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's the same deals. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah?
These are the far right. These are the people that some of the biggest companies in Canada and the ones that are supposed to be the most responsible corporate entities in this country, they're hiring these people to come in here to weigh in on our public policy and regulatory decisions. I mean, TELUS, Bell, and Rogers are wheeling in the far right of American political economy think tanks, like the Mercatus Center from George Mason University, right? And this Law and Economics Center. Anybody that reads the intellectual history of the Chicago School knows these as key touchstones. And NERA, the National Economic Research Agency that I referred to earlier, another one of these entities. I mean, Jeff Eisenach was Trump's telecom policy advisor. And these are all guys that are on the payroll with Bell, Rogers, and TELUS and making the arguments. I don't think you can import right-wing, far-right ideas with impunity and without having some kind of negative effect on the political culture in this country. And that our companies would do that, to me, is a badge of dishonor.
That was Dwayne Winsett, professor at the School of Journalism and Communication at Carleton University in Ottawa. He's also the director of the Canadian Media Concentration Research Project. If you want sector-by-sector, data-driven approaches to understanding Canadian telecoms, check out the work. You can find them at cmcrp.org, and you can find Dwayne on Twitter. That is all linked in our show notes. Last week, I went to IKEA. I needed some basic stuff. Bed sheets, a mirror, a bookshelf, the kind of stuff you can get for cheap there. But so much of what I wanted was just completely missing. I even wanted to buy some of those cheap plastic storage bins. And they had the bins, but they didn't have the lids. It was so strange. I'd never seen anything quite like it before. But of course, these times are different. We are in the middle of a global supply crunch. I'm sure you've seen the news. It's affected cars, microchips, furniture, food, and all of that stuff at IKEA. Part of the story is just we are reeling from the massive global disruption that is COVID-19. But it's also a monopoly story, because monopolies across the global supply chain have made the problems worse and have made them persist longer than they should have. That's what I've learned reading Matt Stoller's Substack. It's called Big, and it's about all things monopoly. He's also the author of an indispensable history on the subject, Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly and democracy. I called him so we could have a wide-ranging conversation about monopoly in our day-to-day lives and in our politics. We talked about the global supply crunch, the Biden legislative agenda, the anti-monopoly movement, and the intellectual foundations of monopoly policy. He's just the kind of guy for this conversation. Matt's a dogged journalist, a historian of monopoly, and a tireless campaigner against monopoly. He's also advocating for good old-fashioned populist trust busting. But another thing I really like about Matt is he's just a good educator. He reveals the surprising ways that monopoly affects us on a day-to-day basis. Like, let me start with another monopoly story from my own life. It's a monopoly story that I didn't know was a monopoly story till I read about it in Matt's Substack. Back in the days when I used to be the kind of person that might go out to a nightclub, say, I would go to this place called Granville Street in Vancouver, BC, and it was this strip. And we would go out, we would drink too much, I'd leave the bar, I'd be obliterated. And as one does, you go out for snacks. And as a Canadian, it was often poutine, but oftentimes it was I would go to McDonald's. And there was one right by the bar I went to. I would go, and invariably every time I would ask for a McFlurry, and the machine would be broken. And then what I would do is, you know, I was like, you know what, man, it's okay, because three blocks down, there's another McDonald's. Let's walk over there. And we would walk over there, and invariably the machine would be broken there too. And I never quite understood this until I read your work and the monopoly tie-in. So what's the deal with these McDonald's machines?
Yeah, so there's a great story in Wired about this. McDonald's has a deal with a dominant maker of food service equipment. So one of the machines they make is the McDonald's ice cream machine, which is way too complicated and hard to repair. And they sell this machine to the McDonald's franchises. And if you're a McDonald's franchisee, so you own an individual restaurant, you have to buy your equipment and everything only according to the specifications that McDonald's, the franchisor, says. And then McDonald's probably gets kickbacks for forcing its franchisees to actually buy this equipment. And then there's also a big maintenance contract. So there's a company that started and like built this tiny device that you could hook to a machine that would make it much easier to repair. And McDonald's and this food service equipment maker basically drove this company out of business and said to the franchisees who just wanted the ice cream machines to work, no, you can't buy it. There are all sorts of problems. There are legal impediments. There are safety impediments. Just to basically retain their monopoly power over these franchisees and these, particularly to retain the maintenance contracts. And so the machines are always broken because, you know, if you want to fix them, you have to go to this you know, through your these very sort of elaborate process from a monopolist who's charging you a lot of money, and the machines don't really make any sense. They're hard to maintain, and there's nothing that they can do about them. So one way to understand the McDonald's problem is that it's a shortage. It's an artificially created shortage. It's not like there isn't enough cream or sugar. It's just that there's a monopolist that has a financial arrangement where there's an incentive to not have these machines work. So it's an artificial bottleneck that's created there because a monopolist makes money from it. And that's a shortage. And we have these kinds of artificial bottlenecks all over the economy because fundamentally a monopoly, we have a public policy regime that encourages monopolization, and monopolies are really just taking advantage of a bottleneck. That's what a monopoly is.
Yeah. This piece that you wrote in Substack that kind of like articulated, I think, like five principles to sort of like understand the supply crunch. I thought it was really, really helpful to explain, you know, not just the McDonald's problem, but problems all over the place. Just to summarize really quickly, I mean, you wrote about monopolies manipulating prices and lowering supply, the interoperability problems, which I wanted to talk to you about, the right of repair, which is that McDonald's ice cream problem, infrastructure and power buyers. So if you're game with me, could we take those kind of like step by step? I mean, what is the manipulating prices and lowering supply? And in the article, and especially you talk about meatpacking, but other industries as well. How does that figure into the story of the supply crunch?
There are basically four big meatpackers in the US, but they control 85% of the meatpacking capacity. They consolidated the industry in the early 80s. And since then, they've shut about 200 meatpacking plants down. And what that means is that the consumer is paying record prices for beef, and the cattle rancher, the producer of cattle, they're getting actually pretty low prices. And it's the middleman, the processor, the beef packer, who's getting most of the spread. So that's creating inflation, and it's also deeply harming independent businesses and ranchers. And so that's the manipulation of prices. And that's what you see kind of like all over the place, this attempt by industries. I mean, you see this with like shipping container producers. There's three main ones and they're all in China, and they're not producing as much as they could because they want to keep prices high. And so without competition, any economist will tell you that's like a standard problem that monopolies or concentrated markets produce, which is less supply than there would otherwise be to keep prices higher. And that creates shortages.
I mean, the average listener might think, okay, well, bigger economy of scale. Matt, what do you have against the big meatpacking plant? They're probably more efficient than the mom and pop shop that can only just do a few. So how does that break down? Is it that sort of fragility that's baked into that system?
So there are economies of scale. And some of these meatpacking plants are bigger and they are in some ways more efficient. But they're also, it's a much more fragile ecosystem. And you'll have much more specialized products. And then all of a sudden, if a certain kind of beef can't come in, then this whole supply chain is optimized in one particular way. One little thing goes wrong, it throws that whole supply chain off. Because they've shut so many of these plants down, and now they have very few plants. They're bigger plants, but there are many fewer of them. When you have a problem with one of these plants, like you had a fire in 2019, you had a cybersecurity incident in 2020, you have COVID that knocks out a bunch of workers who can no longer see the plant can't operate, you actually will end up having a shortage. And we started seeing limits on the amount of meat that people could buy in supermarkets. So there's often a direct trade-off between efficiency, this hyper-efficiency, and resiliency.
Right.
Sometimes they're not more efficient. I mean, that's often the case as well. Like you have a large factory might be more efficient than a small factory, but if you have 10 large factories, they could be controlled by 10 companies or they could be controlled by one company. There's no real economy of scale of having one company controlling 10 large factories versus 10 companies controlling, you know, 10 large factories. And so economies of scale are often used as an argument for larger firms, larger corporations. But in many ways, the legal entity of a corporation and the size and scale of a productive facility are not related.
What about this sort of second principle of interoperability, which you call sort of like the Keurig problem? How does that factor into the global supply chain stories that we're seeing today?
So if I have a Keurig coffee machine, and I could only use Keurig coffee pods for it, I could have coffee, you know, coffee grounds or other form pods, but I can't use them in the machine. So you could have a shortage there. Even if you have enough coffee and you have the machine to make the coffee, if you don't have a standard, other coffee pod makers could conform to. So this is the case for biopharmaceutical equipment that makes vaccines. So there are these plastic bags that are very fancy that you need to basically mix. You attach them to mixing machines and you mix materials, and that's what produces vaccines or other biopharmaceutical products. Well, that industry has been consolidated in the last 15 years into four players. They all sell a bunch of different products. They sell the bags, they sell the machines, they sell pipes and a whole bunch of stuff, and it all connects to each other. And what they've done is they've said, oh, our stuff is only going to connect to our stuff. So there's this comment during the vaccine, when we were talking about how to make enough vaccines, which we're still not making enough of. They said, oh, well, we don't even have enough plastic bags. But it's not that we didn't have enough plastic bags. It's that the plastic bags from one, you know, they work on one machine, don't work on a different machine, and, you know, and vice versa. And that's because there's no standard, because when you have vertically integrated industries of dominant actors who sell a bunch of different types of products, they don't want a standard. They don't want their stuff to interoperate. And again, that creates artificial shortages.
Independent media couldn't be more different than the corporate monopolies that run the rest of Canadian media. Let me give you just one example of what I mean. You know where I've been reading my Rogers Board news? The Toronto Star. And in each and every story, they have to write this in the middle of their article. David Peterson, who is one of the directors Edward has sought to replace, is also vice chair of Torstar Corp, the company that owns the Toronto Star. That's corporate media for you. It's incestuous. We don't have that problem. We don't even run ads. But we do need your support. And here's how you can do that. First of all, if you're new to the show and you haven't already, subscribe. You can find us wherever you find your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, hit us up on Patreon. That's at patreon.com/startsandletters. Okay, back to my interview with Matt Stoller. The Democrats are currently negotiating over two major bills, the infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill. The reconciliation bill is currently slated at $1.75 trillion. The infrastructure bill, $1 trillion. That one just passed the Senate, and now it's at the House. We've seen months of haggling over both these bills, and there's going to be some more haggling. Much of the conversation about the bills has been about the top numbers. How much are we going to spend? I wanted to ask Matt Stoller more about how this would affect the monopoly story. Would this massive public spending just go to reinforcing existing monopolies? We started with the infrastructure bill.
So I looked at what they're saying with broadband and what they're saying with railroads. And broadband, the issue there, at least in the US, is broadband is expensive because you don't have any other options. You just have, you know, Comcast or maybe Verizon. And oftentimes you just have one. And so you're a price taker. They just tell you what the price is going to be. There are a couple of ways to address this. You could put price caps on there. Or if you're going to be spending some money on infrastructure, you could say, well, we will finance municipal broadband to compete with Verizon or AT&T or the local monopolist. And when you do see competition, like in Chattanooga, there was competition where the city actually said, we're going to have gigabit Ethernet for everyone. And then all of a sudden, AT&T invested a ton of money in anybody who, you know, in that area and said, okay, well, we can also do gigabit Ethernet. But without that competitive drive, they won't do it. So in the infrastructure bill, a Republican named Susan Collins, and the Democrats acceded to this, so it was kind of a bipartisan agreement, made sure that the money that's going to go to be spent on infrastructure will not go into competing with current dominant incumbents. They could go to subsidize those incumbents. It could go in areas that those incumbents don't serve. A lot of it will go to basically poor people who can then buy service from those incumbents. But there won't be any competitive driver. And so it's really not going to do very much. I mean, and in fact, it's likely that by the time the infrastructure is turned on in a couple of years that comes from this bill, it will already be outdated. The only thing in the reconciliation bill that would have done anything was something on prescription drug costs, which prescription drugs are often very monopolistic. The pharmaceutical firms engage in anti-competitive behavior. And the Democrats proposed a price cap, which isn't perfect, but would have dealt with some parts of it. They also did a few other things on rebates and kickbacks, which would have been good. But that's largely going to be pulled out of the legislation. So what you've seen is, I think, you know, our policymakers, they look at, well, our job as policymakers is to spend more money on something or to get people have more access to this public system or whatever. But they don't actually look and see how those systems are operating, right? So when we did a healthcare bill here, it was Obamacare, which is, you know, 10 years ago, they were like, we need to get more people access to the healthcare system. But they didn't actually look in and say, how are hospitals working? How are pharmaceutical firms working? What's actually going on with emergency rooms? And so when you have a pandemic that hits, we did some things very well. Like in the US, the vaccine is free and anybody can get it. And I mean, this is not a shocker to Canadians, but it is a surprise to Americans to have a free medical service. But also, you know, a lot of the emergency rooms and a lot of the medical facilities, we just didn't have enough capacity because we've been shutting stuff down for years. Again, it's this, you know, the hospitals have been merging into a monopoly. Mm. So policymakers are not, you know, they're starting to think about market structure as a driver of policy, like of social policy, but they're still not there, right? They're still thinking, oh, if I want better healthcare, let's dump a bunch of money into healthcare, as opposed to let's think about how the healthcare system is operating and whether there's competitive dynamics. The same thing is true for broadband. Oh, you want better broadband? Let's put some money into broadband companies and that will fix it. As opposed to thinking, what are the incentives that these broadband companies have? Let's make sure there's competition there so that they are forced to actually invest in improving products and services.
You've written in some places, and I've heard you in some places, sound optimistic at times about kind of a resurgent anti-monopoly movement. And Tim Wu, Lina Khan at the FTC, you've described as a kind of strong academic with populist credentials. And where are you now in terms of your sort of optimism about where both the Biden administration is in terms of anti-monopoly and the wider movement, if that's a fair term?
It's really interesting because the anti-monopoly movement is doing, we're doing really well. We have a lot of people in positions of authority, you know, versus where we thought we'd be. We didn't think we'd have control. We thought we'd have to kind of beg people in these institutions to pay some attention. But that's not the case. Lina Khan is the chair of the Federal Trade Commission. Jonathan Cantor will be the head of the Antitrust Division. Rohit Chopra is the head of Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We've got people in important positions. And that's good. And I think you're going to see some positive consequences of that. You know, you're seeing more and more attacks on big tech, consolidated power, which is really helpful. And on the right, you're seeing more recognition of market power as a problem, which is useful. Still, though, I mean, the broad, you know, when you're talking about Congress, when you're talking about the political parties, they're still both stuck in this like 1980s mindset of let's have lower taxes or higher taxes, more spending or less spending. Let's dump money into systems to expand them or not. And we haven't really internalized the problem of competition as a core driver of how we compete, how we do business, as a core driver of social outcomes. We're getting there, but like if you talk to most members of Congress about my issues, they'll say, oh yeah, I like antitrust, that's good. But if you actually ask them about how market structure or competitive dynamics relate to any social concern that they care about, it wouldn't be an obvious answer for many of them. They wouldn't be able to think about that. We're still educating. People are still learning about how to talk about the problem of market power.
Your book, Goliath, also talks, you know, a lot about sort of forgetting the anti-monopoly history of the populist movement and erasing it. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. Who were the people that sort of ushered in this kind of intellectual shift away from that tradition to what, you know, you talk about in some places like a left libertarianism, for instance? There's kind of a left and right version of the monopoly story.
You know, I was surprised. I wrote my book, Goliath, and I wrote it for Democrats because I'm a Democrat. And I was like, Democrats need to understand their history. And actually, a lot of the people that really liked it were conservatives, which I was surprised at. And the reason is because there's two movements that undermine the anti-monopoly tradition. Everybody in my world understands, okay, well, one of them was at the University of Chicago. It was the libertarians. Yeah. These are people like Milton Friedman and Robert Bork, George Stigler. And they made a series of arguments saying that antitrust law was basically a problem and shouldn't be we shouldn't enforce antitrust law to address concentrations of power because concentrations of power are really irrelevant. Corporate concentration didn't matter. What we should really look at is whether things are being done efficiently. And if we consider just consumer prices, then we'll have a more efficient society. But of course, what mm-hmm. that did is it undermined. You can look at like Walmart, which wasn't really that important in the 70s. And after the Chicago School took over, Walmart exploded. You saw consolidation across the economy in lots of different ways. And so those are the people on the right, and they really developed a lot of the legal tools. But the reason the conservatives thought, oh, this makes sense is because I also pointed out that there was a big part of the technocratic elite that took place on the left in terms of trying to eject the anti-monopoly tradition. And this was largely the consumer rights movement. Thinking about yourself as a consumer versus a citizen, that was the big triumph of the left in the 1970s. And these were people like John Kenneth Galbraith and Richard Hofstadter, an economist and a historian. And then not maybe Nader himself, but a lot of the groups around Nader, they started thinking that, you know, how you do business is not a moral question. The only moral question is whether you're pro-consumer, which meant you were anti-business. And so the traditional model was, you know, labor and consumer and small business versus the monopolist and the financier. They took small business out of that and said, okay, it's just consumer and worker versus business. And that really changed the way that our politics worked. And it led people to think, and there was this, you know, the right wing, the Chicago School libertarians, they were able to convince people to think in terms of consumerism, vote with your dollars in the marketplace kind of thing. Like the idea that the only power we have is as consumers to choose what we buy at the supermarket. That shift of thinking about who we are as people, that was the triumph of the left in the 70s. And so those two movements, they didn't like each other, but those two movements were able to say, no, we're going to replace the way that we've done antitrust and regulatory policy to look at concentrations of power. We're going to replace that with economists who are just going to do the math to tell us how to make this system super efficient and forget about any power.
I can see them being not too friendly because you look at sort of the Nader camp and it has almost like an anti-corporatist tinge to it. I mean, it's about consumer rights and abuses. But I can see also what you're saying here, the kind of apotheosis of it being like, well, as long as the product is fair or like with a lot of the monopolies of today, free, like what could be better than for the consumer than Facebook, Google Drive, all the various systems that we're using? That seems like so perfectly tailored to that kind of left libertarian model of consumer rights, consumer advocacy.
The other part of it is you have to have a vision for how you want business to happen, how you want commerce to happen. And I think the flaw with the Naderites was they looked at small business, big business, and they said, we're just going to throw regulations on them because they're all bad guys. Right. And there was an anti-corporatist tinge to it. Like those groups often didn't like big business, but they didn't like small business either. They just didn't like business. Right. And they didn't like big labor. They didn't like big government. So there's a good book that just came out on this by Paul Sabin. It's called Public Citizens. They didn't have a vision of a society that you can govern because you have to figure out, all right, how are we going to structure our society? And the anti-monopolist said, we're going to place as much power as we can in the hands of the little guy. And that, you know, that means, by the way, that the local store owner is going to, you know, he's going to have some power in his town. There will be other stores and there will be competition. So he's not going to have like a ton of power, but he's going to have some power and he's going to misuse it sometimes because that's what people do, right? And it's not everybody, but like, the idea is that concentrations of power, if you can reduce them, you should. But you should always be suspicious of power, but recognize that power is inherent to every society. It's inherent to life. And what the problem with the left libertarians in the 70s is that they're utopianists. They don't actually have a vision for how you actually run business in a way that is manageable. They don't have respect necessarily or didn't have respect for commerce. Ultimately, like you have to set up a society where commerce is a bedrock because people need stuff. They need to make stuff, distribute things, books, ideas. That's a big part of who we are. And so there was no affirmative way to do that in the Naderite framework. Like if you go back to the you know, Louis Brandeis and the anti-monopolists, they had a vision for how to run business, more co-ops and things like that.
I can hear people in the back of my mind that are listening to this conversation, kind of lefties like myself, who will say, well, okay, Matt, but, you know, let's not lionize the small business. I mean, there's a phrase called like small business tyrant, and sometimes they can be even worse than a large business that sort of has more eyeballs on it in some ways. What do you say to that kind of objection?
Look, there are assholes in this world, okay? The question is, how do you set up a society where people can be a free people? It's like harder to bully you and force you to do things that you don't want to do. And how do we set up a society where you can develop yourself as a person and as a citizen and as a community member? If your goal is to get rid of all assholes, if you're a utopianist and that's what you want to do, there is no solution there, right? You can only deal with human nature as it is, right? And so I think the kind of open question is like, is the goal here to do the best with what we have, which is this flawed, weird thing called the human being? Or is the idea that we can create this revolutionary transformation in the soul of the human being to eliminate all bad things? That's ultimately what you get down to it. Like, there's just going to be some jerks out there.
That was Matt Stoller. He writes a Substack called Big, and he's author of Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly and democracy. You can follow him on Twitter at Matthew Stoller. And that's it for this week's episode of Darts and Letters. Our lead producer is Jay Coburn. Our managing producer is Mark Epilonio. We have research and show notes from Dave Moskrop. Marketing is by Ian Sowden. As always, our theme song and outro was composed by Mike Barber. Our excellent graphic designs are done by Dakota Koop. And I'm your host and editor, Gordon Caddick. You can send us your feedback by emailing the show. The address is darts@citedmedia.ca. Or you can tweet us at Darts and Letters. Darts and Letters is supported by our generous patrons. Thanks to our most recent ones, Mark, Justin, and Sam. Join us and join them by going to patreon.com/dartsandletters. This is a production of Cited Media, and we are backed by academic grants that support mobilizing research and democratizing the concept of the public intellectual. The founding academic advisor of the program is Professor Alan Sens at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for listening. Check back in next Friday.